Women were essentially second-class citizens in the ancient world. There was such condescension about women and their roles and status. And the fact that Luke's gospel gives so much attention to Jesus ministering to women, some of whom are even named in the gospel, is very unusual in the ancient world. It's surprising. This story tonight is not just of one woman, but two, a dying girl and a woman who has an issue of blood. And we consider these two from Luke 8. They have a different age and social situation that we could observe. There's a daughter of a ruler who seems to be a younger girl. She is described as 12 years of age. And then there's an outcast woman who doesn't have the status, it seems, of the ruler of the synagogue, who would have been respected and widely appreciated socially. This other woman was unclean. She was no doubt an outcast. And no matter where she turned for help, there was no one who could aid her. And this chapter gives us the story of how each of these women meet Jesus, and the meeting of Christ, the encounter with Christ, the Lord, changes things for them. He is Lord over nature and demons and disease and death. These stories from Luke 1 to 8 have demonstrated his power over all of this. These two stories are also reminding us of Levitical laws, which Christ is fulfilling by bringing cleanliness where there was uncleanliness, not violating the law, but the discharge of blood would have rendered the woman unclean. The corpse of the young girl in Jairus' home would have been unclean. And so while the authority of Christ is on display here, in particular, he's bringing the flow of life and cleansing to what was not clean. Matthew and Mark tell these stories. And these two miracles, in fact, and in Matthew and Mark's accounts, they have sandwiched them together. And I use that term a lot when we were in Mark's gospel, because a way of arranging Mark's narratives was a sandwiching technique, where you would have an outer set of slices and then something in the middle. And here, the story about the dying girl begins the narrative and ends the narrative. But in the middle, and Matthew and Mark record it this way too, the account of the woman with the discharge of blood is in the middle of the, in this case, Luke's sandwich technique, all right? And so as we look at this story, the embedding of the discharged or bleeding woman is surrounded by the dying girl in Jairus' home. Same way Matthew and Mark report it. Let's look at the concern for Jairus' daughter that's raised in verses 40 to 42. Jesus has been on a boat. He's been traveling west across the Sea of Galilee. He has recently left Gentile territory, heading back into the Promised Land, and people are ready for him. They no doubt were not eager to see him leave and have been awaiting his return, though we're not told how long he has been gone. And when Jesus returned from the episode earlier in Luke 8, it tells us they welcomed him, the crowd did, for they were all waiting for him. It doesn't tell us how glad or not glad his disciples are at this. They're probably used to Jesus being followed and stalked by all kinds of people for different reasons. And here you have a great crowd ready to follow Jesus. This means that these episodes here in Luke 8, 40 to 56 are witnessed by larger groups that are accompanying, with the exception of the closest confines with the resurrection of Jairus' daughter, where only a small selection of disciples are brought in. But along the way, we're to just imagine, I think, this crowd going with Jesus and the 12. And there came a man, no doubt among this crowd, in verse 41, named Jairus. Now, he is burdened personally for something going on in his home, so he really needs Jesus to get back across the lake. I mean, he's checking his watch more often than the others, you know what I mean? Like, he's got a dire situation where his daughter, sick from something, diseased from something, we don't know, is dying. We're told his name. This is significant. And when a name is given, The reason I said it's significant is because the early readers of the Gospels would be familiar with people whom the Gospel writers gave a name for. So many people are unnamed, right? Including the woman with the discharge of blood, including the daughter of Jairus. We don't know the names of those two women, though they're included. But Jairus would have been someone respected within the Jewish community. He's called here in verse 41 the ruler of the synagogue. That's the head of the place where they would gather on the Lord, on the almost said the Lord's Day, on the Sabbath day, right? And they're only meeting on the seventh day right now, right? And so they have this ruler of the synagogue who is overseeing all kinds of things. The acquiring and reading of scrolls. He is helping maintain the maintenance of the synagogue. There is an overseeing of readings and prayers and people speaking. The ruler of the synagogue has an important role. It's this man who comes falling at the feet of Jesus. That's a very undignified posture. And the reason we have to note that is that someone of reputable standing who then is casting themselves in such a what looks like even a reckless way, an undignified way. Here is someone who is not interested in what other people are thinking about what he is doing. He only wants to talk to Jesus. And he's falling down, casting himself down at Jesus' feet and begging him, imploring him. I don't think we should see him as like whispering or like, you know, in gentle tones. I think this is a man who is becoming undone in front of everybody and he doesn't care. He's begging and pleading with Jesus to come to my house. Well, verse 42 tells us why. He had an only daughter, 12 years of age, and she is dying. Now, in Mark's gospel, in his account in Mark 5, we're told that Jesus is asked by Jairus to come lay hands on his daughter so that she might be delivered. That makes even more explicit why Jairus comes to Jesus and falling before his feet. Jairus believes that if Jesus can get to my daughter in time, my daughter doesn't have to die. This is a desperate father who, whatever social or political reputation and honor he held in the eyes of others, it is not as important to him at this moment as getting Jesus to his address. Now, this is the second time in Luke's gospel where there is a desperate parent with an issue with a child. And I say desperate parent, I'm thinking about a parent whose circumstances have overwhelmed them. The desperation for the widow at Nain would have expired in the sense of hope from her perspective. But nonetheless, her distressing circumstances, just as the father is in some distressing circumstances, the widow at Nain in Luke 7 had an only son. What's interesting then about the previous chapter in Luke, there was a woman with an only son and Jesus worked a miracle. And here is a father with an only daughter. Sometimes Luke will put together male and female pairs, like in Luke 7, the mother and her son, and here the father and her daughter. Here it tells us Jesus went, and as he did, the people pressed around him. And in verse 42, going, I take this to mean Jesus is agreeing to the synagogue ruler's request. And this must have been so encouraging. Jesus didn't say no. In fact, he begins to move to this area. And as Jesus went, the people pressed around him. And that description sets up what happens next, because there's this crowd of people going around Jesus, and it's like pressure that would mean people are beside him, behind him, in front of him, bumping. I mean, we've no doubt had experiences. We were walking in tight crowds. We don't remember what that was like anymore, but back when we did, walking and everybody was on top of each other. You know, we've been to Manhattan on a number of occasions, and I'm just telling you, just the busyness. And I remember in D.C. it was the same way. Going to some of these other cities where the tourism overflow is so intense, you do feel like as you're walking, you're just like in gridlock, right? And it's not even traffic so much, even though that's true too. The crowds are so thick. And the thickness of the crowds following Jesus, it would be difficult to picture how vast a sea of people from time to time are following this man. And as you would expect, people are around him. And somebody from behind comes up to touch him. And in verses 43 to 48, this scene and this contact is introduced as the faith of a bleeding woman is highlighted by Luke's account. In verses 43 to 48, and there was a woman. So earlier we were told about a man. There was a man who was a ruler of a synagogue named Jairus. Here there is a woman. So a man introduced earlier. Here now a woman introduced. This is very common in Luke's gospel to see that kind of interplay. There was a woman who had had a discharge of blood for 12 years. Notice that she's been bleeding as long as Jairus' daughter has been alive. That number 12 sounds familiar in this part of the story because it was just mentioned as a number in the earlier part. When Jairus' daughter is 12 years old, and this woman has had an issue of uncleanness for 12 years. She had had a discharge of blood, and this means she has been in a state of perpetual impurity. It doesn't give us any more medical details here, but we do know because of how much in the background books like Leviticus are for the Gospels. We noted so many stories, by the way, when we were going through the book of Leviticus of different stories in the Gospels that Old Testament book touches over and over again. And this is one of them. In Leviticus 15, an issue of blood would render someone unclean for a time. That blood would then stop, and somebody would go through a natural ritual of purification and resume normal life. But this woman, not for days, not for just weeks or months, but an ongoing issue for 12 years that has affected her life, rendering her perpetually unclean. This means that if she were wanting to go and worship at the temple or join the people in the festal throngs during the feasts of Israel's calendar, this kind of gathering and that kind of assembly at the temple, those sorts of things were not permitted for somebody who is unclean. This is not a woman who is able to enjoy life as it once was. We don't know what brought this on. And we don't know what age she is. But for 12 years, this has afflicted her. And it tells us, though she had spent all her living on physicians, she could not be healed by anyone. That language tells me how desperate she is, right? Doesn't that signal to you that she's been willing to try anyone, no matter what it has cost her? She has just spent her living. We're not told anything about her family. We're not told if she has other financial resources or support that's supplemented this at all. But at least we know in verse 43 that she has sought a remedy for this. And who can help her? No one has been able to. But according to Mark's gospel, Mark 5:27, it tells us she had heard about Jesus. People had been talking. She had heard what he can do. Now, maybe others with a situation of bleeding or uncleanness had been healed by Jesus. We're not told, even though some summaries of his miracles are given in a few spots already. But we are told that she had heard things about Jesus. And therefore, when he is coming and this crowd is moving and they're following, it doesn't matter if he's going to Jairus' house. She's convinced that he can deal with her problem as well. She's with this crowd. And she comes up from behind. And in verse 44, I think the impression we're to get is that she doesn't want to draw attention to her situation. It would be embarrassing. She would be unclean socially, ceremonially. And so even that gathering in public and mixing among the crowd is not something that would be looked upon very, very lightly or positively. So she wants to be stealthy, right? So she's like sneaking up behind Jesus. And her mindset, I'm not saying she's correct in thinking this, but she is thinking that Jesus is so powerful and his authority is so overwhelming that his very garment, the edges of it, the hems of it, perhaps even the tassels of it, where sometimes Jews had elements of the word being expressed and symbolized, perhaps if she could just touch those things, she would be well. There was this ancient Near Eastern idea in elements where magic and sorcery were practiced and pursued, though in vain. There were still ideas that garments, clothing of people in power or royalty could have some kind of thing that even coming into contact with it would mean good fortune for you. It would mean positive, you know, karma for you, for lack of a better bad word, you know. And you have this idea of this woman, her mindset thinking, given who Jesus is reputed to be, it's as if that garment would have what I need because it's connected to him. So she came up and touched the fringe of his garment. And immediately, this is incredible, 12 years, 12 long years. And I mean, this ends immediately. She knows it. We're told in the Gospel of Mark that she felt within her the change. That's incredible. And so in Mark 5, we're told that she sensed immediately that something had happened. Well, now, she's not the only one who's going to sense something, all right? So just in a moment, Jesus is going to speak. But here it tells us immediately the discharge ceased, and Jesus asks a question in verse 45. Now, does he stop at this moment? He is asking, who was it that touched me? She might not have even realized that she came in, now, if she came in contact with his skin, even the hem of his garment, some kind of contact is what Jesus discerns. That would have been alarming. She's going to try to be so stealthy about it, right? Now, here, this question, while it's considered by the disciples, you can imagine people around the crowd saying, well, I didn't, or at least not a kind of contact that would make Jesus ask this. Everybody's denying it. Peter said, and this is really to explain, Jesus, how are we supposed to know? Master, the crowds surround you and are pressing in on you. So you're asking who touched you. I mean, Jesus, come on, look at all of the people. They're all pressing around. I think that's Peter's way of saying, well, we're not going to find out. But Jesus said in verse 46, someone touched me, for I perceive that power has gone out from me. That's quite a statement, I think. Power has gone out from me. Jesus realizes that contact has been made and that he, the life giver, someone has come to him and they have been healed, apart from the kind of typical encounter we've seen in other places where Jesus lays hands on someone or he in some way hears what ails them or others. Here's this woman coming up from behind Jesus, touches his garment, then backs off. She realizes something has happened, and then Jesus is just stopping this whole proceeding. This is a different kind of response to the miracle. I perceive that power has gone out from me. He wants the woman to show herself. One writer put it this way, while a hemorrhage flowed from the woman's body, power to heal flows from Jesus' body. This is a way of saying that he is the fountain and source of cleanliness. And while she had been unclean to that moment, immediately her uncleanness was overcome. And now Jesus has not become unclean. He's the fountain of all of this life. Just as when he has touched a dead body or a leper or any of these other kinds of encounters, which lookers on would no doubt warn him against or tell him not to do. You have Jesus here, not unclean, and the woman has been transformed. Someone touched me, for I perceive that power has gone out from me. And in verse 47, when the woman saw that she was not hidden, she came trembling. Well, she came with an issue of blood, and now, you know, that's been solved. No regrets on that in that moment, right? But at the same time, she is now publicly exposing her identity as the one who has touched Jesus. She's trembling and falls down before him. Well, we've seen that posture before. Jairus fell down before Jesus. And in verse 47, she falls down before Jesus, and now she renders testimony. Not only is she going to come forward as the one, she's going to tell everybody what's happened. And she, it tells us, declared. This is not just to Jesus. She declared in the presence of all the people why she had touched him, number one, and how she had been immediately healed, number two. So her testimony is that in coming to Jesus, having believed that her issue would be addressed by his power, not only had it happened, but it happened immediately. Why is she trembling? Is she nervous about the crowd? Is she nervous about his disciples? Does she think Jesus is going to be upset? Maybe he's, you know, going to scold her, she's thinking. I don't know. The text doesn't necessarily specify why she's trembling, but she is overwhelmed at that moment and nonetheless renders public testimony about what's happened. Her faith brought her. She didn't have everything correct in her mind, but she knew Jesus had power that could deal with her affliction. His response is so encouraging. In verse 48, first of all, he calls her daughter. Now, she's not his biological daughter, right? We have to immediately recognize that's not what this text means. It's a term of endearment, though. For all we know, she was older than Jesus. We don't know her age. She's at least for 12 years been dealing with an issue of blood. But Jesus speaks with identifying her as a precious person. Daughter. Daughter, your faith has made you well. Now, the woman may have attached more of the effectiveness to the contact with the garment. That's not what Jesus is going to tie that to. She, even if she doesn't have everything clear in her mind at the moment, she came to Jesus believing that Jesus had the authority to deal with what was going on. And that was a kind of faith he recognizes. Daughter, your faith has made you well. That's what was on display. Not magic from the garment, okay? This is the woman believing that Jesus had the authority and power. She had heard things about Jesus, and she knew she would not be an exception to his authority and power. He could deal with what she had. The word made well or healed, your translation may say something like your faith has healed you, is the same word sometimes translated in the Gospels as saved. Because salvation was not just something that was inward. Deliverance could also be outward as well. That was a kind of deliverance, a rescue, to be saved. You could render this, daughter, your faith has saved you. She's come to Jesus. And what she is understanding about what has happened, it's more than just physical, perhaps. More than just an issue of blood ceasing. He says, go in peace. And that's a good way of closing that conversation for someone who's come trembling and is having to declare to the crowd what's happened when it's not clear how anyone's going to be responding. Go in peace, Jesus says. She didn't come that way, but she does leave that way. Jesus has come to bring peace. He's come to bring peace to the disorder of the sin and its effects in this world. He's been delivering from affliction throughout his public ministry. And here she is a recipient, a beneficiary of his kindness. Your faith has made you well. Go in peace. Those are very affirming words. Those are endearing words. Those are words of blessing. He sends her out under the blessing of his peace. But however close they were to Jairus' house, this encounter, which was probably not some, you know, 25, 30-second encounter, we're reading such a concise, you know, summary of the events here. A delay has resulted in the daughter of Jairus dying. So we look at the last part of the passage in verses 49 to 56, and we're told that while he was still speaking in verse 49, somebody came from Jairus' house, the ruler's house. They come to Jesus. They must have been close. And he comes right up to Jesus and he says to Jairus, your daughter is dead. Now, if you're Jairus, that is such a heart deflating moment. Your thought in going to Jesus was, my daughter is dying. Come save my daughter from death. And now you are told your daughter is dead. And then the spokesman says, do not trouble the teacher anymore. Whoever this envoy was, their words are essentially saying, hope is lost. No need to bother Jesus anymore. Go on home. In fact, things have so been quickly arranged, the death of the daughter must have been so imminent and approaching that mourners and other professional musicians were already on the scene to mark the kind of public grief and lamenting and wailing that was common for the ancient Near Eastern world. When Jesus shows up there, there will be not just parents and his disciples, but there will be others who are marking public mourning and lamentation. Your daughter is dead. Don't trouble the teacher anymore. But Jesus doesn't address the envoy here. In verse 50, he says to Jairus, do not fear. And Jairus, his heart, we'd understand why there would be such an overwhelming sense of sadness and grief and fear and distress. And Jesus says, let's stop that. Don't fear, only believe, and she will be well. Now, he said earlier to the woman with the issue of blood, your faith has made you well. And he says to this father about his dead daughter, she will be made well. What? This is some kind of promise. In verse 51, Jesus continued to the house. Jairus, let's go. We've been on a journey here. Why are we going to stop? Let's keep going. And yes, the circumstances with the daughter have changed. Jesus is still going there. Now, I don't know if you're Jairus, if you find this encouraging or not. Jesus has just told you, only believe and she's going to be made well. What are you expecting in that moment when Jesus arrives at your house? When he came to the house, Jesus allowed no one to enter with him except Peter and John and James. So it's going to be just a small excerpt from the group, from the 12. Peter, James, and John will be among those who will see his transfiguration in Luke 9. They'll be with Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. There are a few occasions where Peter, James, and John have some extraordinary experiences associated with Jesus. So this is one of them. And in verse 51, as well as Peter, John, and James, there is the father and the mother of the child. So let's take role, okay? There's the dead daughter. There's father and mother. There are Peter, James, and John, and then Jesus. And so what is that? Six people alive and a dead daughter. And it tells us in verse 52, all were weeping and mourning for her. This just means on their way in, these are the people that they would have seen. Weeping and mourning for her would have been the professional mourners and lamenters. And Jesus says, do not do what you're doing. Now, this is their job. They're here to serve a grieving family. And Jesus says, stop what you're doing. This is so strange. This would not have been their first opportunity to go and serve a grieving family. This happened whenever there was a death. It was common, it was customary for mourners and wailers to come. There would be musicians who would play and people who would cry and rend their garments. It was all to demonstrate the grief that was present in this home. And Jesus says, you can all stop doing this now. Wait a second. First of all, they know what it is to see someone who has died. And they have been dispatched. They have been called to this scene. So other people believed in the imminency and then the finality of the death. There is not going to be a situation where these mourners are used to anybody saying to them, hey, you need to stop this. What is going on? Do not weep, for she is not dead, but sleeping. Now, if anybody else spoke that way, you can see why it would be terribly unsettling to people. It feels insensitive. She's not really dead. I mean, imagine if we were part of a scene of grief and sorrow where there was a body and a family grieving, and somebody comes along and saying, that person's not dead, they're just sleeping. There can be a, sort of a bristled effect among people, mixture of feelings as to, okay, wait a second, but what's he mean by that and what's coming? And here, don't weep for she's not dead but sleeping, as if waking her up is as easy as waking somebody from sleep. It speaks of a more temporary condition, doesn't it? They think Jesus is ridiculous. They begin to laugh, which is quite a switch from what they were there doing. There's the weeping and the mourning and the lamenting and the wailing, and now they're laughing. But their laughing is more in line with scorn. They think this guy is crazy. They laughed at him, knowing that she was dead. This is not a gladness deep within their heart that at last someone has come. Jesus is here, everybody. We can definitely stop this weeping. She's coming out of this. No, they laugh at him. They know a dead body when they see one. Now, Jesus takes her by the hand, and he doesn't have to touch her. We know that there are miracles, like with the father in Luke 7, not the father, the person with the servant who was ill at home, where no distance could keep Jesus from healing him. So here, Jesus is in this room and takes this girl by the hand. That is so tender. And he says, "Child, arise." And just like the Lord in Genesis 1 who says, "Let there be light." Where there was no light, there is light into the darkness. Here where there was no life in the child, there is life given. By the word of Jesus, it's as if the word imparts this power and life to the child. "Child, arise." And her spirit returned in verse 55. Her spirit returned and she got up at once. What a moment. Peter, James, and John aren't going to forget that anytime soon. Nor would the mother and the father. These wailers and mourners, they've not been to a situation like this unless they, you know, used to work in Nain, and then they decided to come and work over here because strange things started happening in Nain too. And here you have, in Luke 8, the Spirit returning to this child, reminding us of the ministry of Elijah and Elisha. We're told that there was a dead son of a widow in 1 Kings 17, and the dead son's spirit returns there as well. Jesus is a greater figure than even Elijah or Elisha were, but those were two of Israel's, what you might call, healers or miracle workers who did wonders by the power of God. Jesus not only raises the widow's son at Nain from the dead, he raises this father's daughter from the dead, and in John's gospel, he will raise Lazarus from the dead. Jesus does more raisings from the dead than Elijah or Elisha ever did. And then by the end of the gospel, he's coming back from the dead too. Her spirit returned. She got up at once, and he directed that something should be given her to eat. I think this would certainly confirm for all the witnesses around that this was a real thing that had happened. This wasn't like the mother or father just, you know, having some kind of a mystical experience. We're going to go get some food from the kitchen. We're going to bring this to this girl, and she's going to sit and she's going to eat. I guess being dead makes you hungry, because she comes up and she's immediately ready to eat. And it tells us that they did. Her parents are amazed in verse 56. Her parents are amazed, and he charged them to tell no one what had happened. The amazement, that theme in Luke's gospel has been seen already, and in the book of Acts it will be seen as well, since Luke is behind both volumes. The amazement of the power of God. Her parents are astounded. How could they not be? There's just no trying to interrupt what's going on. If you're watching TV or looking at your phone, your mouth's hanging open at this point. And whatever you thought was going on for the rest of the day, this is just preoccupied everything. Because you have your daughter who was dead, now brought to life, and she's eating, sitting up. We don't know what she was ill from that made her die. But that's not a problem here either. We do need to clarify that whenever we see these people come back to life, these are not people coming back in an immortal, imperishable body. This is not a glorified body, like will be the case with Jesus' resurrection. These are still foreshadowings of a glorified body and resurrection of the dead. So while we call this a resurrection, it's not like a glorified existence that this young girl will come into. In fact, though she's 12 years old here, she will die again. This does not secure her, if you will, apart from death. And the same was true for the widow's son at Nain in Luke 7, and the same thing with Lazarus. Jesus is the first fruits of the resurrection of the dead in 1 Corinthians 15. That doesn't diminish the amazement of this scene. It just requires us to be clear on what has happened and what has not happened. This is not the perishable putting on imperishable. That will happen for the dead at the return of Christ. Did you notice at the end of verse 56 that he charges the parents to tell no one what had happened? How would you keep this quiet? First of all, the mourners and the wailers who are there, they know something has happened. Good luck keeping them quiet. They were laughing at Jesus. They think he's ridiculous anyway. And whatever scorn they were willing to heap on him is just now reverting, swinging the other side, right? Well, now they've seen something amazing, and Jesus wants the parents not to tell anyone. Why? It's not clear in the text why. Maybe Jesus doesn't want undue attention and curiosity showing up at the doorstep of this young girl. Perhaps. Maybe there is already a sense in Jesus' ministry that the wonders and miracles are sort of ginning up the kind of interest in the crowds that's focused only on those wonders and outward and physical things, missing the greater bread of life that's right in front of them, the living water that's right there for their souls. And perhaps Jesus, knowing the condition of people in the crowds, like he doesn't want to add to any additional unhealthy interest. So perhaps things like that. I want you to notice how these two miracles, which were sandwiched together in Luke 8, have some commonalities. I pointed out a few of these along the way. Both Jairus and the bleeding woman fall at the feet of Jesus. In both accounts of Jairus' daughter and the bleeding woman, there's the use of the term daughter. That doesn't just happen, you know, every other paragraph in Luke's gospel. So when it happens in such close proximity, it's worth noting. Both stories, both miracles, have the number 12 associated with it. Both conditions are distressing and desperate. There is the immediacy of the healing. The bleeding woman stops bleeding immediately. And Jesus says, "Child, arise," and immediately she sat up. There's contact. The woman comes up from behind to touch Jesus. And Jesus takes the hand of the dead girl. There's an impurity or an uncleanness that's overcome. The flow of blood had rendered the woman unclean who was bleeding. And here the dead daughter, Jairus' daughter, would have the uncleanness that a corpse would have. And then there is the recognition of deliverance or being made well. In the case of the bleeding woman and in the case of Jairus' daughter, both are described as situations that Jesus made well. In Luke 7, I want to tie this as well to the widow's son at Nain who was raised. Both of those are stories of someone coming back from the dead. Both of them involve somebody's only child. It's an interesting connection where the widow who had an only son, here you meet a father with an only daughter. Both of them have echoes of the Elijah stories in 1 Kings 17. And in Luke 7 and in Luke 8, Jesus says to different parties, "Do not weep." And it's not because he's trying to be insensitive. It's just what he's about to do is not going to warrant sorrow and grieving. There's going to be celebration and joy and restoration. When I think about a passage like this, and I think about the storm at the sea that Jesus stilled in Luke 8:25, it tells us at the end of this, his disciples, "Who then is this that commands even winds and water and they obey him?" And we can take that question as a kind of template and ask it about other things. Yes, who is this that even the winds and waves obey him? But who is this that leprosy obeys him? Who is this that a legion of demons obeys him? Who is this that fish in a sea in Luke 5 obey him and overwhelm the nets and nearly sink the boat? Who is this that a man with a withered hand experiences the authority of this Savior? Who is this that the winds and waves? Yes, but who is this that even death itself will obey Jesus? Friends, these miracles continue to make the cumulative point together, mounting evidence that the identity of this one, this is the Son of God and Son of David, come near, who by the power of the Spirit and in the will of the Father is ministering life over the effects of sin and all of the uncleanness present in the fallen world. He's taking people and making them whole and making them new. He's forgiving sins. And we could add that as well. Who is this who can say, "Your sins are forgiven"? This is what the religious leaders bristled about, right? Only God can forgive sins. Only God can still the storm. Don't demons only shudder before God? Who is it that can raise the dead? And all of these questions hit at that same answer. Indeed, in Jesus Christ, God has come near to sinners to deliver them. Praise God.